Monica Moskal from the College of Forest Resources will talk to us on seeing the forest through the leaves, quantifying forest structure and forest ecosystem services with LIDAR. Monica?
Thank you. And I realize that I am the final obstacle that stands between us and the reception. So my goal here is to be fast and get through this on time. Today I'm going to be talking about something a little bit different, although we've seen quite good examples of remote sensing throughout our sessions. Almost all presenters had either aerial photos, Google Earth. So remote sensing played a pretty good role here at communicating our research, and I think remote sensing is a unique tool that can bring a lot of scientists together to the table and begin a discussion. My other goal today, instead of just finishing quickly, is to convince you that remote sensing has gotten to a point where we can begin to look at our environment at a very fine scale. So scale came up a few times this morning. And I like to think that we're getting down to, if you think of trees, down to seeing things at a leaf level. What you're looking at here is a ground-based LIDAR image taken. It's an image, but the data is not collected as an image. The data was captured in Arboretum in 2005. And I basically just flattened out the three-dimensional data set to produce this picture here. And you can definitely begin to see, got a little bit of ahead of myself. You can definitely begin to see tree structure characteristics. This is the stem of the tree, branch architecture, and unique leaf patterns within the data. So this is very high resolution remote sensing. It's an active sensor, meaning just like this laser, an energy pulse is directed at the object. The only difference is the sensor actually has a way of timing the return of the signal back to the sensor. So one of these a little bit more sophisticated. All right, got ahead of myself. I like to think of remote sensing and high-resolution remote sensing as a set of tools. And if you think of geospatial technologies, remote sensing, GIS, geovisualization, surveying, GPS, they all are a toolbox. Remote sensing is part of that toolbox. I like to think of the high-resolution remote sensing, and I refer to that sometimes as H-resolution remote sensing, as the sharper tools on our knife here. So sharper meaning we have a lot more definition. We can see a lot more edges if you think of this visually. A lot of my research in remote sensing sits on the edge of applying and developing techniques for these high-resolution technologies that really are beginning to be the main tool in the remote sensing field. Although the traditional remote sensing tools are often also utilized. So when I think of remote sensing, I often think of hyperspectral, hypertemporal, and hyperspatial remote sensing. And all of these have one thing in common, which is their resolution. Again, that resolution being very high, being able to see things at a very fine, fine detail. If we think of hyperspectral resolution, this is being able to see very small increments, measurements along the electromagnetic spectrum. And today I'm not really going to be discussing the research that I'm interested in that deals with hyperspectral remote sensing, but I do want to kind of set the stage here for you and explain how LIDAR, which is what I'm going to talk about, fits in within this diagram. Next thing, hypertemporal remote sensing. We've seen some really good examples of multi-temporal remote sensing. I've seen multiple dates of aerial photography used as a tool to show landscape change. Hypertemporal remote sensing, time series, having that data at a much higher resolution. And many of you are probably aware we've been collecting hypertemporal imagery now since the 1970s. So we have observations of our globe at about weekly, biweekly, to monthly increment for the last 30 plus years. That's thousands of images at a global coverage. Now, I'm talking about this hyper, but I think it's important to mention that sometimes what you gain in one resolution, for example, in the spectral resolution, you might lose in the temporal resolution. Or if you gain something in the spatial resolution, you might have to give something up in the temporal resolution. For example, the hypertemporal remotely sensed data is very coarse spatially, meaning that the units of observation on the ground from the 1970s are about 1 kilometer in size. That's the pixel resolution. But hey, we got global coverage and we have it for 30 years. So there's a give and take there. We're improving on that resolution, and the last few years are now 250 weekly, biweekly observations. The loss in hyperspectral resolution is also something that hypertemporal imagery suffers from. The data that I'm mainly interested in deals with two locations of the electromagnetic spectrum. The red portion of the spectrum, where a lot of photosynthetic energy is absorbed by plants, and then the near-infrared portion of the spectrum, where the energy is reflected by the structure of the plants. We take that information and we formulate a vegetation index. So this hypertemporal data, we get a vegetation index that allows us to monitor change at a global scale for the last 30 years. That's all I'm going to talk about that, but it is an area of research that I find very, very fascinating as well. And I'm exploring a few projects that utilize this hypertemporal remote sensing, specifically trying to tie it to dendrochronology of trees and potentially looking at pine beetle susceptibility as well as fire susceptibility. So finally, hyperspatial remote sensing. This is really what we're going to focus on for a good portion of the presentation here. And we're actually only going to focus on one little subset of the hyperspatial, which is the active sensor, the LiDAR sensor. Hyperspatial just meaning you see a lot of spatial detail. You have that fine edge. I think of LiDAR as hyperspatial because you get that three-dimensional fine resolution data. And of course, that type of data has some very good applications to forest inventory, characterization, and even more importantly, forest structure, which can be tied to some ecological functions of the forest. With all of these tools, new methodologies of dealing with hyper data are needed. So there's a big development on tools that utilize the spectral information, harmonic analysis that utilizes the temporal data, and feature extraction has become a very big tool in high-resolution remote sensing. This is very interesting because aerial photography, right from the 1930s, is actually still very high spatially resolved data set. And we're now faced with the tools that allow us to bring that data and explore it, quantify it, and look at it over temporal scales. So there's a really big resurgence of work with aerial photography due to this hyperspatial remote sensing, which really stems from hyperspatial satellites that entered the customer market in the year 2000-2001. So we're going to go back a little bit, back to the future here, to the future, because right before those satellites were available, I was really interested in remote sensing and started my graduate work in Canada, in Alberta, looking at application of high resolution imagery to forest inventory. And we were very lucky to have an aerial sensor that had characteristics of the upcoming satellite sensors that weren't up yet. So we flew that sensor at different altitudes and acquired imagery that had very high per pixel resolution, starting from 60 centimeters to about 2 meters. And we played around with these data sets to see what kind of forest characterization we could extract from the data. One of the trends that you see here is that our accuracy, for example, for species actually improved when we downgraded the data to or used a coarser resolution data of 2 meters. The reason for that is because we used techniques. We didn't have techniques to deal with high spatial resolution imagery. So we used traditional remote sensing techniques that tend to fail with this high resolution data. So we're at a point now where you have to be very careful when you choose a particular technique, because there are so many different data sets that you could be working with. We also looked at extracting tree crowns, basically looking at stand density and crown closure. And again, our average error, this is a little bit different. Our average error increased as we utilized the slightly higher resolution imagery. All of these results were much higher than what you could traditionally get with coarse resolution remote sensing, like a 30 meter pixel of a Landsat sensor. So even though you see trends, decreases, increases, all of this is far beyond what we could do with a Landsat satellite. And speaking of Landsat satellite, Landsat is still a very useful sensor, and in fact, majority of remote sensing is done with Landsat. This is an example where we used the Landsat coarse resolution data and some geostatistical methods. And how many of you were here last year? You listened to Christian Turgeson explain geostatistics, so it's your job to explain geostatistics to the people sitting next to you. I'm going to assume that you understand the concept. It's actually quite simple concept. Things that are closer together are more similar than things that are farther apart. So based on that fundamental Tobler law of geography, we utilized field data and develop models that not only used the reflectance values out of the remotely sensed data, but used field information to improve our modeling techniques. Again, for various forest inventory characterization, the example here is for basal area in Yellowstone. And I'll have quite a few Yellowstone examples here because that's where my PhD work concentrated. So you'll see a little bit more of that. The really big point that I want to bring up with this slide is remote sensing by itself is a weak tool. You really need the field data. There's no replacement for it. When you have field data, you can improve your remote sensing modeling. So I think I will always believe that field data is the only way to calibrate our remotely sensed models, no matter at what resolution we're working at. So I mentioned ecosystem services in my title, and I want to talk about them a little bit more. I have a few examples here of the different groupings of ecosystem services, and you see a few big names in remote sensing literature that are dealing with these specific issues, such as provision services, such as energy, biomass, specifically biofuels and availability of biofuels. The ones that you actually see reviews next to is because these are the things that I'm also interested in. So the literature I'm reading, this doesn't mean that there is less research being done in, for example, cultural services, but as what our one of two anthropologists mentioned, it's difficult to do cultural research with and resolve that research develop a language with sort of the hard and soft scientific research that's being done. So there's definitely a little bit less literature, even in remote sensing, available in that particular ecosystem service. The take-home message here is that a variety of ecological applications require data that is at a very fine spatial extent, but also data that covers landscape, large areas. And I believe remote sensing data is the best technique to address these needs. And that might be high spatial resolution data, it might be high temporal resolution data, it might be high spectral resolution data. In fact, I believe that the fusion of those data sets is what creates the synergy to produce even better variables to bring into ecosystem service research. Okay, I said I'm going to try and convince you that leaves is where it's at. A lot of the work in the research unit that I came in to work in concentrated on looking at trees, looking at stands, and developing parameters for trees and stands, doing a lot of monitoring on that with LIDAR. So this is the Precision Forestry Co-op in the College of Forest Resources. As I came in, I was thinking of what are the unique skills and ideas that I can bring to the table, and I think one of these is this idea of leaf area index, the green stuff that's on the trees that obviously relates to biomass, relates to the ability of the canopy to absorb and utilize and capture rainfall, relates to carbon sequestration, and so on. Leaf area index has been extracted out of remote sensing at landscape levels for a while now. There's been various techniques to do that. It correlates very highly with net primary productivity. It correlates with rainfall interception and carbon sequestration. It's really the ratio between the leaf surface area and the ground area underneath. And there's a lot of controversy. Deciduous trees, broadleaves versus conifer leaves have a slightly different method of calculating leaf area index, but that's the general idea there. Leaf area index has also been quite difficult to extract for forests that are heterogeneous. And those are not only urban forests, but old growth or mature forests tend to have more heterogeneity than, let's say, even-age stands or managed forests, in fact. So that brings me back to some of the skills that I gained in Yellowstone, looking at the various age classes and mature forest stands there and looking at their leaf area index from remote sensing. There are various leaf area index measurement techniques other than remote sensing. There are the direct methods, so relying at taking a statistical sample and destructively sampling a tree. Of course, trying to do that in the UW Arboretum might be a little bit difficult. There are also indirect methods, non-destructive methods, and that's where remote sensing falls under. And of course, we have the passive and active types of tools to do the leaf area measurements. I'm going to throw out another geostatistical modeling here. This is leaf area index out of Landsat data. The example here is only four post-fire regenerating areas. And what you can basically see, the main point is that areas that have higher leaf area index tend to saturate and have higher errors in our models. And this is true not only for the young stands, it's true for even age stands, it's true for mature stands. We found with this, or I found with this research, that we benefited, or I benefited, from splitting out the different age classes and modeling these classes independently. But the take-home message is there's saturation at high levels of leaf area index. So, LIDAR, one of these lasers, you might have even had recent interactions with LIDAR technology if you were caught speeding, probably. Last time I had an interesting interaction with LIDAR was at my dentist. Apparently, your cavities have a slightly different way of transmitting light, and they can pick them up with lasers. So, the unique characteristic of LIDAR data is that it provides three-dimensional structure information. So you get to see things instead of flat-out images like aerial photography. You get that third dimension out of the data. And, of course, that's very useful to produce things such as surface canopies. What you're looking at here is not pure LIDAR data. This is fusion between aerial photos and LIDAR points. LIDAR doesn't have color. It has intensity. Most LIDAR data has intensity, but that would be represented as black and white. And, of course, we also get a very nice topographic model if you're looking at landslides. And even if you're studying trees, this is an important variable because we can't measure anything about the forest canopy without first developing a really good ground-based LIDAR terrain model. So if you haven't looked at the Puget Sound LIDAR Consortium, this is the time when I throw that out. These guys produce very good models. We have a lot of coverage over Western Washington, not so much over Eastern Washington, but great high-resolution data sets, anything much, much higher quality than what you would get from USGS. And just to give you an example here of measuring the structural information out of LIDAR point cloud data. This is an example of LIDAR data software that was developed by the Forest Service. This is how we measure our trees. We actually extract the point cloud. We can measure down to the bottom part of the canopy, the top part of the canopy. Of course, we have the ground, crown diameter, all of these great characteristics out of the LIDAR. Here's a comparison between aerial and ground LIDAR. So this last September, we took out a ground-based LIDAR unit out to the Arboretum and played around with it a little bit to try and get at finer resolution characteristics and some unique findings. For example, you can do DBH with ground-based LIDAR. You can only get DBH out of an equation or a relationship developed between other characteristics of the crown out of aerial LIDAR data. Crown segmentation. One of the unique things about LIDAR is that it's a three-dimensional data set, although most of the techniques that we use to work with this data is to flatten it out and then use traditional image analysis methods. So last summer, I worked with a graduate student to try and improve on working in the three-dimensional space and separating trees that way instead of segmenting them on a flat landscape. And that makes sense, especially when you have co-dominant trees. When we flatten this data out, essentially it's the number of points below an area of ground. Dominant trees will have more denser distribution of points, and when we try and separate them, we tend to overestimate their crowns and take out characteristics out of a co-dominant tree. So here's a new technique, sort of looking at segmentation in the 3D space instead of flat image space. And the final thing, the LAI. I have a graduate student who did some of his master's work looking at leaf area index through different techniques in the Arboretum, looking at these heterogeneous forests. He collected almost 100 field plots, collected hemispherical camera imagery, sort of a traditional way of doing LAI, but he also used airborne LIDAR over the Arboretum and ground LIDAR. One of the unique things that Jeff developed was, instead of just, this is the preliminary work, I don't want to give out the final results here that we're trying to submit into peer review, but the saturation that you see here that we saw in the Landsat data as well at higher LAI values, we have a way of fixing that a little bit because of the structural information that LIDAR provides us with. So we're very happy with those results. And the final idea here, where is all this data going? Well, remote sensing is not the only discipline that plays in the satellite aerial imagery realm. I think of myself as someone who produces information, who produces models, but these models are geographically correct, so they have a geographic position, they're spatially explicit, and they contain real world information instead of interpolated information. And those models can then be used in geovisualizations, for example, even if it's for very simple educational purposes here in the Ozarks, explaining land use, land cover change rather than graphs, flying through the simplified landscape and showing land use, land cover change. So with that, I'll just leave that up there, and hopefully we have some time for questions.